Fayetteville. It's Mid-South Summer School. And a friend of mine had listened to his tape. I didn't know I was going to have to introduce him today, and I asked him anything nice I could say about him, and he said just the truth. But a friend of mine had listened to his tape, and I don't know that his voice particularly impressed this friend over the tape. And she said, I hope he's not a wimp. Well, she shouldn't have said that, because at summer school and all the people, and I walked up and I said, she hopes you're not a wimp. And he isn't. He's one of the nicest fellas I've ever met. He's got a wonderful sense of humor and so positive, so very positive. And no more from me, Larry Kay.
I'm Larry Kowalski. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I have not found it necessary or desirable to take a drink or a mood-changing chemical of any kind thus far today, or any today since May the 21st, 1972. And I am very, very grateful for this morning for that. I had attended a few conferences and heard this term, the committee. I want to thank the committee for this or for that. And about 3 years into my sobriety, I had the honor of being asked to talk at Tri-State in Shreveport. And I had it pictured that I would arrive at Shreveport, and on the steps of the hotel, there would be this group of people with little kind of things that said, the committee, holding this basket of fruit and opening the door. Well, Shreveport was much like here. I was able to drive faster from where I lived than I could fly, because I'd have to make a double or triple connection. And I drove in the rain to get to Shreveport all the way, arrived in the rain, put my car in the parking garage across the street, and I stowed every cent that was in the poor fund of the first church I was for 3 years running, so I don't exactly trust people. So I put my luggage over in the lobby, or the entrance to the lobby, and I'm trying to get my ticket to the car and run back before somebody can do what I would do, and that's run off with the luggage. So I get the car ticket, go running back, and I get with my luggage, and I get the official greeting. A woman walked up to me, and she looked at me, and she says, are you our bellboy? Well, I thought that was as fine a welcome as I've ever had from a committee until I arrived here. I arrived in the area Friday night and went to visit Jeff, a very, very close friend of mine from the Lawton area originally, and got here about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, didn't see anybody, so the committee couldn't get to welcome me until yesterday morning. Yesterday morning I woke up and did all the things a person normally does when waking up, and I was sitting. Now, I live alone. When a guy lives alone, I don't necessarily take all the precautions that you do when you live with people. I don't close doors when I go to the bathroom or things like that. You know, I'm not embarrassed by my own nakedness. So yesterday morning I was sitting on the toilet, and I look up, and there was, I guess, the committee. Standing in my doorway, welcoming me. The cleaning lady. So I came in here, and I guess the committee is trying to make sure they'll never have any trouble having speakers in the future. Because I come in the room, and this rather attractive young girl comes down to me, and she says, I'm your hostess. I'm supposed to take care of all your wants while you're here. Gonna be a good weekend, huh? I imagine Yvonne got kind of her boyfriend or something. I don't know. Word gets out on this, you're gonna have a 10-year waiting list of speakers trying to get here. I want to get to Fort Smith. They do things in a big way there. It'll be one of those kind of weekends. Okay, let's go to the Bible. I think we need it. If I remember, I'd like to share. I think I have three stories I'd like to share one time or another. If you believe in the Bible a certain way, listen to it however you believe in it. Christians aren't agreed in the way they listen to it. I think sometimes there are just stories that have meaning for us, whether we believe in it or not, and that's how I hope to do this, so that I don't offend anybody's sensibilities if they believe in the whole Bible or part of the Bible, just the part up to the through the Old Testament, what we would call the Old Testament, or if they don't believe in the Bible at all, or the Quran, or anything. But one of the very first stories deals with one of the stories on the origin of man and woman. And in the story itself, the people don't have the proper name. The word Adam originally is simply the Hebrew word for man, the man, and Eve is woman. And man exists. The man exists, and he's alone. And it's not good for man to be alone, we're told. And so nature is offered him, and nature is in a suitable companion to fill him out. And he's put into a slumber, and a rib is taken from him. And the woman is made, and he recognizes her equality with him. This one at last is flesh of my flesh and bone of my bones. And for this reason, we're told, a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his woman, and the two become one flesh, one whole person. It's one body, one entirety. This text, I feel, has been abused by people to show the superiority of man coming first. I don't think that's in this at all. I like to take stories and boil them down to their simplest meaning, and from this, really come to an understanding. And the simplest meaning of this text is that man, the man, is incomplete by himself, because he's still lacking part of himself. And the woman is incomplete by herself. She can't exist fully complete. They need each other to complete themselves. Now, as a Catholic priest, I would hope this doesn't necessarily mean that literally a man needs a woman in a full union to complete himself, but I really think that's in the Bible. And I really do feel that our clergy, the priests and the nuns, have suffered a certain degree of incompleteness, which in a lot of cases has been extreme, but in other cases it's just moderate. It is not good, it's not evil for man to be alone. It isn't the fullness of man to be realized alone. But what I really feel this story does, going just apart from the sexual area, is tell me that I can't be everything I am without you. I need you to complete myself. No man, no woman is an island unto themselves. I start off with this because I write a daily 10-step. I do it in writing because I have found I can't achieve the same honesty just thinking my inventory as I can writing it. But despite the daily 10-step, every 2 years I update my own fourth step. Writing by the day is like looking at wallpaper directly in front of the wallpaper. The pattern is missed. And you have to step back sometimes to see a pattern. And by the day, I can miss things. 2 or 3 years ago, being sent to Sterling, which is a nowhere town in Oklahoma, a town of 650 people, 46 years old at that time, I'm 48 now since Yvonne started that damn custom of having to identify your age. 46 years old, I saw I was going nowhere in the Catholic Church. After Sterling, they don't give anybody the cathedral. And being 46 years old, I went into midlife crisis, and I was unaware of it. By the day, I would simply see a lot of depression and a death of goals and a death of dreams. And only stepping back finally and seeing I've been in this a long time and seeing that all my dreams have died, could I see the pattern and recognize where I was in. By the day, I would have been treating the symptom rather than recognizing the real problem. And until I recognized the real problem, I couldn't do anything about it. Well, recently I began my last update. And normally what I do is I look at all the big areas of my life, and I don't read what I've been writing in my daily inventories. I throw those away because I don't want anybody to discover them. Periodically, I throw them away about every 4 or 5 months. I didn't want them to be found, and I didn't want to get into the ego trip of wallowing in my past inventories. But I look at my life in big areas, my relationships with God, my relationship with the church, my relationship with my blood family, my relationships with AA, my relationships in different areas, and I just look at the sweeps. Where's been my strong top periods and my weak periods in these areas over the last 2 years? And I started out this inventory this way, but all of a sudden, it changed. Of itself, and this hadn't happened before, but I believe in flowing with things like this. And it turned into an inventory on relationships. And I was astounded to see what was coming out, and it hurt very much. I saw that 13 years sober, I didn't know how to relate at all. That I lived in a castle, and it had a moat around it and a drawbridge. And I had the drawbridge up, and every so often I would see you outside, and I liked you. And I would let the drawbridge down, and I'd come running over, and I would touch you. And I would come running back inside the castle and pull the drawbridge up and keep nice memories of you, and I would call that a relationship. You out there were to keep nice memories of me also. And that's not a relationship at all. I know that. And what I described, I very much live. Now, we have heard some good things to point out some points. So often people get, I think, a naive idea that sobriety is an unbroken stream of growth. It really isn't. It certainly hasn't been for me or for most of the people I know. Very often, outside problems in the world can really rock everything we've established. We've heard two fabulous examples. And if you don't have the tapes of this conference, if you haven't had the opportunity to hear the speakers, and I'm not in any way wanting to load you down with guilt, I get to hear a lot of speakers, and I love to listen to a lot of tapes. Please let me recommend very much that you get the tape from yesterday morning, Bob, and from last night, Yvonne. Yvonne gave by far the best sharing I've ever heard her give, and she touched tonight a point of such sensitivity that only about how Al-Anon for a wife is different from Al-Anon for a mother. And I'm sure many of you are going to be in the position where someday or other you're going to need to hear that and need to know that as you continue to become an enabler, that it isn't because you're sick or evil, it's just because you're so human. And if other people won't be enablers because they're dealing with more distant people, it's so different. And Bob's discussing his walking through terminal cancer, I think, is just so powerful. I've sponsored somebody in the past year who was afraid she had terminal cancer. And I didn't have a tape I could go to and say, listen to this, just to hear somebody who walked through it. And I think that's one of the greatest instruments of healing we've got in AA. I remember when I was 9 years sober, I was teaching in a Catholic high school and got fired for the first time in my life. Priests don't get fired very often. But, I mean, I can do the impossible very easily. So I got fired. And I went running to my sponsor. And he told me something that he had told me earlier, but I forgot it. 10 years sober, he had the only job in his life when he worked for other people, and he got fired after 90 days. And he told me that, and nothing changed, and yet everything was a little bit better because he was in the same place, and he understood. So we've had some very, very powerful tapes. Outside circumstances certainly rocked everything that Bob had built. You know, somebody walks up and says, you're dying of cancer, and there's nothing they can do about it. Having your daughter go back out on the streets and wondering and not hearing from her and feeling the guilt and the blame and trying to straighten out her life, if that doesn't rock a person's sobriety, I can't picture almost anything that did. And I've had things that have rocked my own sobriety that have changed. I may have related better briefly in AA than I am right now, because all of a sudden, the castle I described is literal. I'm sitting in a town of 650 people, and priests are moved relatively rapidly compared to other people. We really don't have a stability. And if you're moved the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth time, you don't develop the roots. You don't develop the relationships. I saw myself with a different attitude toward AA. Most people I know join a group, and I think in their mind this is where they want to establish their sobriety, live their sobriety, and hopefully die in contented sobriety. They're part of a group. When I came into the Sterling area, for the first time I recognized, since this was my fourth or fifth switch in my sobriety, that I was just loaning myself to these groups because I wouldn't be here long. I was going to be part of them for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, and then move on somewhere else. And I wasn't really immersing myself in AA in the place. I have a whole city block by myself, except for renters, that we have a rent home. And I don't see them. There's no windows on that side. And I really don't like them because they have young kids and I don't like kids. And I can't snap at them. I've got to pretend I like them and they're always in my hair. So I block them out. And I look out, you know, I've got a whole block. So I'm like a castle. And I look out my front window and there's a softball park right in front of my front window. So there's another empty block. And I literally am like in a castle with no one around me. And AA is 23 miles away, except for one member. My family's 1,500 miles away, and my friends are all over the country, and I don't have a single friend in this town. And circumstances have kind of isolated me, and I've fallen back on some problems because it is very difficult for me to relate. I've never really learned how to relate. And when I started doing this inventory, I started looking at some of the difficulties. What I do is I don't go back over my whole life. I look at what's happened in the last 2 years, and I always get insights into the patterns of my whole life, and now look at those areas. I grew up in a wonderful family and never learned how to relate. I believe that whenever we start using or drinking, we who are alcoholic or chemically addicted, at that point we stop growing emotionally. So that if you had your first drink at the age of 16, by my theory, and you're 35 now, and you're new in the program, you have the body of a 35-year-old, probably, and the mind of a 35-year-old, but you're acting emotionally like a 16-year-old. Unless you were hurt earlier, and then you froze at that earlier phase. And I think a very healthy thing is to go back to your first inventory and think about it if you've done it already, or when you do it, to ask the person you do it with to help you decide what age child acts like this. And at the end of my first inventory, my sponsor and I both agreed. I acted like a 3-year-old. I was 35 years old, 34 at this time, I think, 35. I had the body of a 34, 35-year-old. My mind was very well developed, but I acted exactly like a 3-year-old. And that's important to recognize. I came in very sick. I listened to a lot of fifth steps. I've heard only one or two people who came in emotionally frozen, sicker than I am. And I feel very sorry for those people. Their pain began even before this. I'm going to describe some of the symptoms of my alcoholism, and I'm going to describe some of the symptoms of how I experience or my reactions to some of the treatments for me. I want to make real clear something. I don't really know of almost a single disease where the symptoms are universal. In appendicitis, some people I hear get upset stomachs. Other people have pains in the side, and I've heard of some people who didn't know anything had happened until the appendix had ruptured and they were facing peritonitis on an operating table. And I don't think I would say that just because I didn't have an upset stomach, the doctor had to be a jackass. I couldn't have appendicitis because some friend down the block had had an upset stomach when he had appendicitis. It's important to recognize how symptoms can differ, because they are different in alcoholism. And this has been one of my blessings, hearing a lot of fifth steps. You'll hear people say, all alcoholics. Please understand from my experience that whatever they're going to say after that probably isn't true. All alcoholics are not liars, and all alcoholics are not thieves. I've heard fifth steps, very sincere fifth steps, because they've gone into gory details in other areas of people who never stole anything or never lied. I lied and I stole, so I'm not trying to escape those labels. I'm just saying that if I tell you all alcoholics lie and you're not a liar, if all alcoholics steal and you're not a thief, alcohol being cunning, baffling, and powerful, and alcoholism being cunning, baffling, and powerful also, you're likely to tell yourself, well, he just said I'm not an alcoholic. You may not have had my symptoms. That's not important. If alcohol brought problems in your life and you continue to drink, you're probably a problem drinker. The single thing I know is the loss of control. Not only do not all of us have the same symptoms, we don't react the same way to the treatment. And I just want to point this out also. You know, just if both of us had an infection right now and you took a shot of penicillin, it might help your infection and kill me because I had a localized reaction to penicillin the last time I got a shot. And the doctor said that could be the warning the next one could kill you if you're not in a hospital when you get it. You can take an upset stomach. I can take an upset stomach for a headache. It'll handle both of our headaches. An upset stomach. You can take an aspirin, and I can take an aspirin for a headache. It'll handle both of our headaches. I'm going to get an upset stomach with it, always. Some people do the fifth step, and they're on top of the ceiling. From my experience, that's a very rare group. But they talk about it in meetings, and everybody thinks they're going to do their fifth step and have this huge emotional high, and they don't. And as they're nearing the end of their fifth step, they start getting depressed, figuring, I did something wrong. I'm not feeling great. I walk out of my own fifth steps almost always feeling worse than I came in. And Marcy W. from Whitney, Texas says, that's just very natural because you just kicked around all the mud in your life. And the natural reaction to looking at all that mud is depression. Most people don't get high or low. They just walk out. My term for it is like they've had a spiritual enema. They're drained emotionally, and they don't know how they feel. Down the line, the treatment has the same promises for all of us, but they're not emotional reactions. So if you don't have my symptoms, a lot of you won't. Yvonne is very different from me. She talked about how her fourth step, if she was to do assets and liabilities, would have been all assets. My first fourth step, I filled three entire tablets because I'm very wordy and I have a lot of insight. You don't have to write a lot. You could have done an excellent fourth step in 10 pages, but my was three entire tablets without one, maybe I think one positive point, because I couldn't see my positive. So you may not have my traits, but you can have my disease. So please don't listen for the differences and walk away wondering if you belong. In any case, a lot of this, as far as I know, I haven't looked at before. It's new looking to share with you in the area of relationships, since this is what the inventory revealed where I'm at now, and I can back up and get some insights from this. First, I never learned in my own family how to deal with my peers. I have an older brother and a younger sister, and I feel I learned how to deal with my equals from my relationships with them. I don't know why, but I really feel my brother hated me, and I really feel he had the ability to hurt me, and he went out of his way to hurt me. He called me big ears. He did everything he could to make my life feel just hurtful, me unwanted. And he'd always get my sister as an ally. So my choices as a child growing up in my family were two. I could be with others socializing, and that meant pain. Or I could pull off and be lonely. But there was no pain, and I opted for the loneliness. It is safer inside the castle than being hurt by you. And that's the decision I learned as a child. And it's my natural instinct any time I want to pull into my home, pull down the shades, lock the doors, because I don't want people looking in at night and seeing everything. That's my excuse, but that's really raising the drawbridge. And I'm upset when you call because it's playing back these old tapes, or I don't want anybody coming in to visit. My pattern was, if we were going somewhere, I want to go in separate cars, so the moment I want to leave and run home, I can run home, or at least to go in my car. And I would rather visit you in your home so I can run when I want than have you invade my castle and come to visit me, because how the hell am I going to throw you out? Tactfully. When I'm tired of you and my insecurities get up. And this is all what I'm seeing. Anyway, being with others meant pain. Just quickly, to review for those of you who heard it and to share with you the feelings I grew up with, I felt ugly until I was like 3 years sober. I couldn't picture my own face because of the big ears, and just made me hate everything I looked like. I belong to those people who don't feel like they have a right to live. I felt guilt for living, so everything I did was filled with guilt and anxiety toward the future. If you don't feel you have a right to live, how can you walk confidently into the world? I don't belong in this world by my feelings. I don't have a right to be in it. At the age of, real early age of 16, I just was convinced I was crazy, would end my life permanently, committed in a mental hospital, not for alcoholism or drugs. I hadn't started them yet. But I didn't think normal people felt what I did and acted the way I did. People don't decide to, well, it's a good illustration sober is. I've shared this. If I never had to get out of my car, I would be perfect. I drive 3,500 miles a month, and in my car, I heal everything that's wrong with me, and I make resolutions that when I get out and see that son of a bitch that I hate, I'm going to walk right over and put my hand there and say, "Welcome back to AA." And I walk into the clubhouse, and there's that son of a bitch, and I head the other way. Next day, driving into town, I have the same perfect resolution, and I hate myself for failing yesterday. And to me, I didn't know that other people will often have these feelings and fail the same way, but I just was sure I was crazy. So I felt ugly, guilty, crazy, and damned. I had a God that I grew up with that was not really the God of the Catholic Church at all, but I was taught that he would happily put me in hell for eating 2.5 ounces of bacon on Friday, if I knew what I was doing. And a God who's going to do that, you know, you take like 3 pieces of bacon and you're going to get as fried as the bacon was, except yours is going to be eternal and he's going to enjoy it. And I just did everything. The money I stole from the poor fund wasn't for alcohol or drugs. It was a lot of it for sexcapades. I didn't have young hostesses provided back then. Maybe she'll show up next time. I'm going to roast her a little bit more before I get through if I keep thinking about it. If she feels guilt when she hears this, good. I felt damned, and there was just no way out of that. With those kind of feelings, it wasn't easy for me to assert myself at all with my brother. My dad was a perfectionist, and if you look at me and you know me, and you go 180 degrees the opposite, you have my father. He came up to about here. He was like Indian shaped. Well, white Russian by ancestry, kind of barreled, thick-necked. Whatever he could do, I don't do, and whatever I do, he couldn't do. I don't know that my father ever read a book in his life, and I'm educated well above my intelligence, far above it, and I'm a compulsive reader. We never had a carpenter, a plumber, an electrician, or a painter in our home. I can't do anything. You know, I was describing a knock in a car to a friend once, and he says, "You know how to fix that, don't you?" And I've learned to laugh at my weaknesses. That's a good way to handle them. And I says, "Yeah, you pick the phone up, you dial the garage, they come get the car, and they bring it back, it's fixed." And I looked at him. This guy was a mechanic. I said, "Isn't that the way everybody does it?" You know, just, I can't do those things. My dad did them all. I tried to work with my dad, and I couldn't do things the way he wanted, and so I was a failure. I can't work supervised to this day, and he didn't have anything to do with me growing up. He kind of moved away, and I understand today in my gut that's because my mother claimed me. And she was so strong and she was so sick that it would have been a major battle for him to have shown any strong love, so he pulled off. Now, my dad died when I was a senior at Penn State. I wouldn't have said where I was a senior, except they beat Notre Dame yesterday, and so they're 36-6, and they're still number one in the country, so I can tell y'all where I went. But I felt nothing at his grave. The eighth and ninth steps allowed me some tools to go and make amends to the dead that had been very helpful, and I used them. And I went to his grave, and I talked it all out, and I carry my father's love as a personal experience today. But growing up, as far as dealing with authority, relating with people above me, I didn't know how to relate at all with my dad. And my mother was and is strong. Since my dad's death, she is nobody capable of standing up to her at all. They had a very stormy marriage because it was two strong people, and this made a lot of fights. And I see that was healthy for them, because with my dad's death, as the way I put it, Jesus couldn't stand up to my mother today. And so she's just getting increasingly sick emotionally, and there's only two things you do unless you can battle her as an equal. You get out of her circle or you surrender. Now, my brother got out of her circle, running to our room, which was his room. I just slept and changed clothes there and locking me out. And I just had no circle to go. I had to surrender. And I got her approval. I'm her favorite. But the price was I had to become what she wanted me to be, not who I am. And in my gut, I have a deathly fear of authority and strong women. I think they will kill me and make me who they want me to be. And so all my feelings toward authority are totally negative, and feelings of strong rebellion. My father set drives I could never meet and constantly criticized what I did, and my mother just made me be who she wanted me to be. And I was remolded into something I wasn't and hated it. By a sad series of coincidences, I never learned to relate in my own area. We had a girl my age in the yard next door, but for some reason we didn't associate with her. And there was no one my age in the neighborhood. So I had to go with my brother when he played. And when he was 7, I was 4, and his friends didn't want me and for anything. So I wasn't wanted. And I don't learn how to relate with him and his friends. I'm an outsider. When I go to school, the same pattern continues. I lived outside a Polish ghetto, and I went to school inside a ghetto, and everybody else, almost to a person in my class, was together all the time. They were friends. They were relating, and I came from outside, just like my image, touched them, and went home. And I never learned how to make friends. I was the second youngest person in the school. Without ever skipping a grade, I graduated from high school at 16 and college at 20, and I don't know how to touch people. I don't learn how. I started thinking, my first friends were idols. I would pick people who had all the things that I wanted. Now, real early, I started getting good grades, so I didn't respect people with the good minds. I had that. I would negate myself. I'd look at somebody who was, I thought, rather attractive, suave, and sexy, because I didn't think I had any sex appeal at all. And they would be the people that I would associate myself with. My closest friend right now outside the program is nearly functionally illiterate. I know he has never read a book in his entire life. I doubt that he's ever read a magazine article in his life. I just thought about it. He's a carbon copy of my dad, except for physically, but in personality. And the opposite of me in so many ways. So I still look for people who are so other than me, but my first ones were, it was idol worship. It wasn't a friendship. There was no equality there at all. There was no relation. Relating. There was just a kind of an ogling. I wish I had what you've got. And it wasn't an equal thing at all. And I would come from far away and touch him and go home. And they were relating in normal ways, and they'd never pay attention to me or call me. I always had to go out and make the calls. I know about being ignored Valentine's Day, just not getting any Valentines and being hurt. The world doesn't pay any attention to me. And when I went, I would have to travel a mile in junior high when I started making a lot of friends. And they were together all the time, and I would come in and spend a few hours with them and go home. And I wasn't part of the relationship, and I'm still not learning how to relate. And I go to senior high, and the same pattern continues. In thinking of sharing this with you, I switched directions and had further to go from my friends. But it was the same pattern, exactly the same pattern. Suave, good-looking, kind of sexy group of guys to hang with, hoping that kind of will rub off and people will like this in me. And coming from very far and trying to touch them and just not, nobody calling me ever, nobody having anything to do with me, and me always going and trying to feel like I was part of a group and never feeling part of a group. Driving up here, I saw something I never was aware of. The first time in my life I felt part of a group was right after I graduated from high school, and it's a group that continued for a while. It was when I started drinking. Alcohol was the answer to my relationship problems. You can take the same difficulty and you can resolve it in a variety of ways. If I had certain forms of cancer, you might operate, you might try x-ray radium therapy, you might try chemotherapy. My relationship problems could be handled in a variety of ways. It could be handled with alcohol, they could be handled with drugs, and they can be handled, I also have Al-Anonism. And I want to show you how each of them handled these problems differently. Alcohol immediately changed my perception of me and you. Yvonne touched on this last night. She didn't make the second point as strong as it is for me. I drank, and when I drank, I didn't feel ugly. I felt electric, not attractive. I didn't feel guilty. Again, I just felt somebody romantic, not in a sexual way, but in an overall way that you would want to be with your group. I didn't feel crazy. I felt brilliant. And the dam just went. I didn't think of God at all. So it changed how I saw myself. I felt I was somebody you wanted at your party, but that's the second thing. I honestly felt that when I took a drink, you opened your arms. And you wanted me. I really felt that. Alcohol then was a bridge to the world. Drugs weren't. Now this isn't the case with everybody. Not all alcoholics are social drinkers. Some are very isolationist drinkers, and I was at the end of my drinking. Some have been through their whole career, and not all drug users will have the patterns I'm going to talk about. But I've checked with some people, and we feel these are safe generalizations. When I took a drug, when I did my drugs, I would do them at a party. I would be with you at your home at a party, and all of a sudden, I'd do the drugs, sit down, pull the drawbridge up, pull into my own castle, and it was good to be there. And drugs made me stop caring about you and feel it was okay to be me. I absolutely didn't relate at all in the midst of a party. And it was okay. My Al-Anonism didn't explode until into my sobriety, when I took a rejection, didn't go back to drinking or using, and turned to another thing. That would be for me to get, I'm lonely in my little castle. So I go out in the world and I bring somebody to join me in the castle on my terms. I will buy my friends. What I will do, I don't give things to people. I loan things to people. Because if I give it to you, you can take it and walk away. I had an entire stereo system in the home of a real close friend, but it was mine. And that friendship did blow up, and I yanked the system back instantly. At the same time, I had 100 nearly brand new rock and roll albums in the home of another friend. That friendship's still going. I got the albums back once I saw what I was doing, that this isn't a way to build friendships. But it's a pattern I had. What I would want to do is bring somebody into my castle with me. Now, if I'm going to pull you into my castle, the only way you're going to come and stay is you've got to be sicker than me. And I've got to keep you sicker than me. And those were the kind of friendships I started forming. And as I continued to drink, so alcohol was a bridge to the world. Drugs enabled me to feel okay in my castle. And my Al-Anonism is I bring somebody sicker than me into my castle, dependent on me, so I'm not totally alone. Because it's not good for man to be alone, and it isn't. In my alcoholism, as it progressed, my level of friends got worse and worse and worse. And I ran, you know, just the way I put this is somebody asked me once to tell them why you shouldn't have relationships when you're brand new in the program. And I came up with two answers, and I repeated them in every talk from that day on, because I think they can really help. When I felt like a pig, I looked for sows to run around with. When I felt like a man, I looked for women. When I felt like a prince, I looked for a princess. And the moments I feel like a child of God, nothing less than a child of God will suit me. And I can go up and down that stand. You know, I can get sent to Sterling, go into a midlife crisis, and come down from a child of God all the way down to pig, and come up to man, prince, up and down. And I'm fluctuating. But when I come in here, I didn't come here because I felt a success. I came in here because I was a failure. And Yvonne used the phrase, water seeks its own level. Two other ways of showing the same thing, or the same thing is, it isn't butterflies that are attracted to dead meat. I mean, to manure. It's horseflies. And it isn't swans that are attracted to dead meat. It's buzzards. And when you're stinking like manure and looking like dead meat, you're not going to have butterflies and swans circling around for relationships. It's really the truth. I can tell how healthy I am by the kind of people circling me. And when I get sick, the sickies start getting attracted. And as I get healthy in my program, the sickies don't want me. Notice real often in AA clubs, now this is going beyond my own experience, but real often, sickies will go, losers look for a loser to sponsor them. And unconsciously, they're saying, I want to get drunk. I was in a club where there was a guy who did about 80% of the sponsoring, and not a single person he sponsored made it to 2 years. 95% of them didn't make it to 1 year. But it was people who didn't want to stay sober. And winners go to winners. I've looked for the best every year of my sobriety for me at any moment, because that's what I need and that's what I want. That's been a good trade I've got. But in any case, my circle of friends, as the water went lower, my circle of friends got poorer. And I ran with some really evil people. And they were my friends. So when I'm saying they were evil, I'm not judging them, I'm describing myself. That's the best way to take my inventory late in my drinking. Now, alcoholism is not a disease of relationships. Bad relationships, I think, are one of the symptoms of alcoholism and one of the areas that make it necessary for people to escape with alcoholism. So I'm not describing this disease in terms of bad relationships. But this is one of the areas where I am right now. And I'm not trying to share something that's going to help all of you. That used to be my need in an AA talk, and I'd feel a tremendous pressure trying to give something to everybody. And I had the pleasure of visiting Don Pritz, our trustee at large, out of Denver right now, for the world. And he said that he talks feeling that God brought one person to hear who really is going to need to hear what he has to say. And that's the person he has to hear. And God has me looking at my relationships and the difficulties, and there's somebody here I feel who needs to hear this. That's the area I want to talk on. So please don't think I'm identifying alcoholism with relationship problems. Alcoholism has a lot more to it. What is it for me? It's a physical compulsion. I've had it from the very first start. They're making some big scientific advances right now where there seem to be some evidence that when we who are alcoholic drink alcohol, it produces a side effect of a barbiturate or morphine or something in our system, so we literally are having like a shot of real drugs. Very different from the normal drinker, which explains the physical addiction. They've never been able to explain before this why alcohol is physically addictive, because there's nothing in it that would make people addicted to it. Now they're coming up with it. I don't care about the explanation. The reality is, when I started drinking, I didn't stop right from my first drink. Occasionally I did, but the reason would always be outside me. I drank because I needed it. I didn't drink for the taste. I endured it till near the end, when just through sheer willpower and perseverance, I started developing some tolerance and some taste for some of the stuff I drank. And I mean, I'm a big drinker. I drink 2 to 3 gallons of iced tea today, and that's how I drank my booze, and I didn't drink beer because you get fat, and I really didn't drink wine because it wasn't... I drink anything in desperation. But my drink of choice would be you get a big iced tea glass and fill it 60% with a smooth whiskey, because I, for some weird reason, I couldn't drink any pure whiskey straight. Now, the Canadian, Southern Comfort and Cream de Menthe, you know, I had the green crap and all that kind of stuff long before I overdrank. That's how much I would drink the stuff, but I had that. But I'm talking about like real whiskey, Canadian whiskey. I couldn't drink it straight. So iced tea glass, 60% full of booze, 30% full of sweet vermouth. That's a Manhattan if you're not aware of it. Put some ice cubes in, a few drops of water, just smooth it out. So also you're not drinking it straight, so you're not an alcoholic. Two of those down immediately so the explosion can start. And with the third one, the bridge was there and life began. And that's how I drank. And once I got it in my system, I drank every time, as much as I could. I had no power over it. But I not only have a physical compulsion, I have a mental obsession. Now, early in my drinking, I wanted to drink as often as I could. Near the end of my drinking, I didn't want to drink as often as I could, but I'd find myself going back with no reason to start the pattern all over again, the chain again and again and again. I mixed alcohol and drugs, and I had a lot of denial. I was doing like tranquilizers. I didn't have the scripts, but they were the kind of scripts a doctor would have given me if a doctor had done it. And so I didn't even consider that drug. So it's hard for me to go back and even picture this. I can't tell you if I had a drug-free day in years, drug and alcohol. If I drank too much on Monday, then I boozed it up. I had pilled it up on Tuesday. If I pilled too much on Tuesday, I would mix them on Wednesday and then back to the alcohol for a few days. Alcohol is clearly my drug of choice. Pot, a little bit, and the pills are backups. But I couldn't face life straight. Something started happening, and that is that there started to be unpleasant side effects. I started doing some strange things. I blacked out every time I drank at the end. I was getting the shakes. I think if that's all that happened, I'd still be drinking. You know, there's a lot of medication that has bad side effects, and we tolerate it. Some people are hurting very bad from arthritis, and they take quercetin, is that? Anyhow, whatever they take causes their joints, they retain a lot of water, and they start getting fat. Well, the relief they're getting from the arthritic condition overcomes the bad side effects of putting on the water, and they'll take it. Some people, for chemotherapy, will lose their hair, put weight on. They'll take that because of what it's doing to preserve their life. Real simple. For years before they had the odorless relief, Bengay. If you had a bad muscle, you'd put Bengay on, and the whole town knew that you had strained a muscle. I'd take the side effect for the good. I would take the side effects of the shakes and the blackouts. They didn't upset me. But alcohol stopped working. I drank, and my relationships were falling apart drunk. I was pulling back into my castle. The bridge wasn't there. And I wasn't drinking in the world. And I was hating myself when I was with you, and I didn't feel you wanted me, and I was dumping guilt. So that I got drunk. When I say alcohol stopped working, I would still get some euphoria in one sense. But all the emotional good it was doing was no longer being done. And I hated what I was when I was drinking. I couldn't live without it, and I couldn't live with it, and I couldn't stop drinking. I had the compulsion so that when I started drinking, I drank to the end. I had the obsession so that when I didn't want to, I started drinking. And that's how I came to the program. With that, when I came to the program, I stopped drinking and using. And I did remember the second parable. I really was hoping I wouldn't forget this. In thinking about the relationships, I started meditating on a story in one of the Gospels where four people bring a paralyzed man to the Lord for healing. And it suddenly occurred to me, I don't like reading into stories, but I'm going to do it this way because it helped me. The man never asks. We're not told if he asked to be brought for healing. Supposing he was paralyzed that much that he couldn't even speak, or even he was screaming no when they were taking him. And I try to feel, that's just, the man doesn't ask to be taken to the Lord, and they say, we're taking you to the Lord to heal you. And I felt in my gut what I felt being that man, and it was panic that I would be healed. And then I did something I've never done before. I've jumped. And this isn't in the Gospels at all. I had the Lord meet that man, me, a week later, and the man screamed out in hatred for being healed. Because, you see, I made him my age. He was 48 years old. And he didn't know how to live. Now, as long as he was paralyzed, people took care of him. They fed him, they clothed him, they sheltered him. But now that he's healthy, they're not going to feed him anymore, and they're not going to clothe him anymore, and they're not going to shelter him anymore. They expect that he can take care of these things on his own, and he doesn't know how. And he's dying. And that's exactly what happened. I came to you paralyzed from alcohol. You took the alcohol away. And sometimes we forget this. Al-Anon's more so, but often in it, we who are alcoholic forget it. Taking the alcohol out of the life of an alcoholic is not necessarily a blessing. You're leaving somebody with a disease untreated. And if I could have lived that way, I would have. And so what am I? I'm 48 years old. When I came here, I was 35 years old, and I had the emotional age of a three-year-old. I didn't know how to relate at all. And my relationships haven't been all that healthy in AA either. I've had a lot of problems. I hadn't talked about my relationships with women. I wanted to include that. When you feel ugly, and you feel crazy, and you feel guilt-filled, well, you're certainly not going to be a Don Juan who throws yourself at everybody that comes along. 43 years old, convinced I could never do anything athletic, I put skis on. And the first time, snow skis, first time I proved to myself I couldn't do anything athletic. I've never learned anything the first time athletically. But I'm 48, I'm an addicted snow skier, I've got four major ski vacations planned, and I've got a beautiful ski style. Now, I've taken a lot of private lessons, but I'm just so proud. I can't do blacks, and I don't think I ever will. I think my knees are giving out, and I don't know if I have the ability for that. But you meet me on a blue slope, and you will see as fine a style and the skiing abilities you're possibly going to meet on that slope, and that's a lot for me to say. And I'm hating myself for all the years I never tried anything because I was so convinced, being 4 years old and not being able to play the way my brother could at seven, that I was a total wipeout. But anyway, there was a side effect to putting the skis on. If you've ever skied, except for the last 2 years when they've made ski boots so light, you wore these horrendous heavy boots. And if you walked in the ski, my first big impression, you looked at all the guys in the ski house and they were strutting. John Wayne didn't look still like more masculine. And I knew when I put those boots on, here was, you know, Kid Raunchy right here. And I loved it. And for comfort in skiing, I bought lighter ski boots the last year or two and just hated it. I went back to heavy boots last year. Hated the loss of sex. But anyhow, I didn't have anything to project. So I didn't do much dating at all. Senior year, I found a gal that I, first guy she'd ever dated. We went steady. Then when I got to college, I did some, the two gals I met were total dominators. One of the gals, the first day I met her, manipulated everything else for the end of, through the whole relationship. She was drawing up the first evening. We met in the morning. By that evening, she was drawing up the list of our mutual friends who were going to come to the wedding. And that just continued. She called every shot, and it was like, you know, I can't stand up to my mother. I sure as hell couldn't stand up to her. I had another gal. I went into the seminary and dropped out for 3 years and met this gal. It's exactly the pattern of the first one. She had me, I could just feel the loop right through the nose. I couldn't resist her either. I met some wonderful gals. I was 28 and had a gal fall in love with me, 18. We had a 5-year romance at the shore. Just perfect, except she mothered me in every which way. And that was the common pattern, the two facets of my mother, dominating me and smothering me and taking care of me. And those were the relationships that I had with women. And that so they're basically the tapes that I had inside here. I stopped drinking, and I've got the disease of alcoholism, and I don't know how to relate, and I needed a solution. Now, the steps handled the disease. What I'd like to do in the little bit of time that remaining is show how the steps are a solution, a guide to the answer to my relationship difficulties 13 years sober. Remember, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous does not deal with alcohol. People miss that. Nor does it deal with the compulsion. It deals with the obsession, the living problem. And if my living problem gets bad enough, I'm going to think drink or think pill. And there will be nothing between me and the thought, or between the thought and the reality. And so the program is designed to correct my living problems. And it can be looked at specifically in one area, like the area of the relationships. The very first thing that helped the relationship was the fellowship. I don't know why the first place, without any alcohol that I ever felt at home, was in AA. I don't know why I felt welcome. I came the only way I could have come. I'm the only person I know who was ever told to do this. And I marvel at so many people who, I'll arrive at a clubhouse and it's like 7:30 and I see somebody new and this is their first AA meeting, first time ever. I couldn't have come that way. I was told to arrive at 8:05 and leave the moment they stood up to say the prayer. Please don't criticize people who come late or leave early. It may be the only way they could come. See, I was dying inside. I was dead inside. I hated everything I was. And there's no way I could have talked to you. I could not have come to that meeting 2 minutes before 8 and stayed there till 8 o'clock. I had to come under the shelter of silence where you wouldn't have to talk. I didn't have to talk to you. And I was told to pass, so I didn't even have the pressure of trying to say anything. They told me, and it was good advice for me, because it just took all the pressure off. Shut up, because you may not know what to say, and you may say something in the early days that will embarrass you later. And they allowed me to talk, and I think they're regretting it ever since. But that was a long way into it. Coming late and leaving early, within about 2 or 3 weeks, I felt at home. I felt part of a fellowship. But that doesn't always continue. You know, you're not always going to be warmly welcomed by AA groups. We're human. I've had some real affronts coming in AA, and I've had some major difficulties. And when you start standing for people, certainly not like the group that put this on, since they're all such marshmallows, they never are up there getting shot at. When you start standing for certain things, and my sponsor's very controversial, his sponsor's controversial, most of the people I respect are very controversial in the program, and I know I am. I regret it at times, but at other times I'm very proud, because some of the things that people object are things that I've tried to do to help other people. And I'm not going to change myself or to swallow my own principles, my understanding of this program, to suit someone else. I have a poster I like. If you whittle yourself down to please everybody, you may discover you have nothing left. And I'm going to be me, and if you don't like it, that's your problem. If I don't like it, that's my problem and God's problem. And that's the way I've got to do this. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to be obnoxious. It means, but I'm going to be me. I'm going to take some strong stands. And if I hear somebody talking at AA telling me about how they're taking Valium, I'm not going to shut up. I'm going to tell them that the experience of Alcoholics Anonymous, as reflected in the book Getting Sober, is that that's exceptionally dangerous ground, and their life may be in danger. I think I owe that to them once. Never again. I don't have to hound them. I don't have to crusade, but I can say it. And if somebody doesn't want it mentioned, that's their problem. You know, some groups don't want any alcohol drugs talked about at all, because we have this crisis of how do we deal with drug addicts. And Don said something that made me realize we can share the program, but we can't share the fellowship. You know, if you don't have any drug problem, then you can't identify in a gut level with the drug addicts. I have both. I can identify with both. So there is a limit to how much we can share. But if you don't want to hear about the drug part of my life, then I'd like to give you your big book. I'd like to rip out about the, I think it's 70 or 80 pages, I think, that mention drugs on one page or another. And if they can be mentioned in Bill's story and Bob's story and yay many other pages of the big book as part of what God gave me, then they can be part of my talk, as long as I don't talk them only to you. Because our big area of identification is the alcohol. That's what brings us together, and that's the area I'd like to, you know, where we start talking. But anyhow, the fellowship isn't always there. Yvonne and I have had some major difficulties. And that's because she takes strong stands and I take strong stands. And, you know, just at times they're opposing stands. And you start shooting at each other. But I hope through all of that, if she ever needed my help and called to keep from taking a drink, whether I liked her or not, I'd be at her home instantly. And the opposite, she'd be at my home. And that's the bottom line. She doesn't have to like me, she has to love me. So I felt at home, but at times I haven't felt that in AA. I felt isolated, I felt apart, I felt shot at. And that's important to know. My answer to relationships can't be placed just on the level of the fellowship. We have more than the camaraderie that exists inside the boat. We have a way out on which we absolutely agree. The second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now here I am, 13 years sober, and I'm discovering I don't know how to relate at all. It's so easy to give in and sit down and cry. The second step is the challenge, to trust. It doesn't deal with sobriety. It isn't could restore me to sobriety, it's could restore me to sanity. It begins with sobriety and goes beyond. I'm challenged to believe that there's a power out there that can help me relate. And I can be helped by that when you share your problems. When I remember in my mind that you said you didn't know how to love anybody, and I see you as a carefree, open, and relating person, then I can know that there is some power that can lead me to where you are, because you've been where I am. And that enables me to take the second step. And that's the one I'm challenged with right now. And then to go on. And to surrender to what I'm told to do. And to me, the third step, made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God. I can't run my own life. I don't know why. I have 12 years of college. With 12 years of college, I'm a total jackass in running my own life. And the best way I see this is sponsoring and being sponsored. I look at somebody I sponsor running full speed over a cliff, shouting, "In the view, great!" And I got to reach out and grab him by the collar and say, "Don't you see where you're going?" Then I look up and I see my own sponsor running full speed over a cliff shouting, "Isn't the view great?" And I see his sponsor pulling him by the collar and stopping him. And all of a sudden I'm shouting, "Isn't the view great?" And I feel a tug. I don't know why it's so obvious to me when you do it. And I don't see it when I'm doing it. And my sponsor has to tell me what to do. And he's told me what to do. The first thing he said was, "Bring somebody into my home every week." Told me that 2 months ago. I haven't been able to do it yet. I'm trying. And I went down and I shared with him the difficulties I'm having with it. But I'm fully willing. And I'm surrendering. It's just so difficult getting somebody to come in. Because you see, I wouldn't accept my own invitation. That's my first excuse. So how could I ask you and take the rejection of your saying no? It's easier not to ask you so I won't be rejected by your saying no. Plus, you're going to come in and invade my fortress. If I could just meet you on the drawbridge, I can sit on it and you on the other side. You're a lot safer. Got to bring them in. But I'm willing to do it. The fourth step, made a fearless and searching moral inventory. I've got to identify the problem. Until I see it in all of its depths, I really don't know that it's there. And that's exactly what this step is. It's taking a good look at my total inability to relate. How I just don't know how. How I've bought people. I'd give out markers. That was my way in my drinking. You know, the Godfather? Oh, I did a lot of favors for people. I handed out markers and called that relationships. I bought people, called that relationships. And I took hostages, called that relationships. I allowed people to dominate me, called that relationships. I had a few people in high school who liked me. I could not even look at them. I couldn't stand being around them. It's like that old line, any club, I don't want to be a member of any club that will allow me to be a member. You know, it's just beneath me. I don't want to be a friend of anybody who'd want to be my friend. Anybody that allows you, I don't want to be a friend of. And that's how I lived. And I had to see all these problems, to see the depth of the difficulty. And then in the fifth step, to share it with somebody. I went down and I told my sponsor about it. I drove down there last Sunday, got the inventory done. And I thought he was going to throw me out of the house. I felt that I was an absolute wipeout 13 years sober. I had some sexual problems revamped themselves, and my honesty was questionable. These are other little areas, but this whole area of relationship, I just didn't feel I should be lying. I'm reading my inventory, and he stopped me about halfway through. He says, "Do you know, in all the inventories you've done with me, this is the first time you're taking only your own inventory? And it's this blindness. I would never have seen that." And it is. For the first time, I didn't have to take anybody else's inventory. Up until now, I've been screwed that bad by authority and by friends. I was taking my brother's inventory, my parents' inventory, the bishop's inventory, priest's inventory, all the people who had hurt me inventory, and I didn't have time to see where I was at. I couldn't see that I couldn't relate. All my problems came from your rejecting me. All of a sudden, I'd grown healthy enough where I could fully just put the spotlight on me, and I was able to see, I don't know how to go out and touch you. And he just said, in all the time he sponsored me, I've never been healthier. Well, as soon as he said the first thing, I could have concluded the second thing. Now, I could never have seen that at all. And so I've got to be open with someone else to see myself better. Now, I've got to be entirely ready to have God remove all this. Entirely. You know, I'm going to have to throw open the blinds and open the door. And it's going to hurt like hell. But only God can help me do it. I can't do that. I'm not mapping out a campaign for me to meet the world. I've got to get rid of all the things by which I keep the world from coming in, where I cling to where I'm at. And the seventh step, humbly asked him to me, that's going to my sponsor. I found God. I found a sponsor, a group, a program, and a God. And that's my chain of command. And if I go to God with anything, I keep it. If I go to my sponsor and say, please give me help, God starts mapping out what I need. And my sponsor gave me a whole set of directions, more last Sunday than just letting people in. Other steps to help me relate. And I've got to be willing to walk on those. With all this, I come to the eighth step, make a list of persons we had harmed. And you know, only now with the spotlight on me am I ready really to see you as a person. Only when I'm stopped blaming you completely can I see you as an individual. Yvonne and I briefly belonged to the same group. And I really never saw what a beautiful woman she was until last night. Because, you know, I'm just looking at her. She's just magnificent, I thought. And just so human. And we spent the whole evening after her talk till about midnight with a lot of you and just shared a lot. We've never related like that. We've clashed like two kind of semi-institutions in AA with our own little views a lot. And we just were able to touch. And, you know, I asked my sponsor if I could share this. And he said, no, you don't share this because you don't use the pulpit to get rid of a personal vendetta. But there's no vendetta here at all. I love that gal right now. I hugged her for the first time ever after her talk last night. I don't know if she knew where I was coming from, but I had nothing but positive love. Because in my eighth step, when I make a list of the people I've harmed, it's I become aware that you're a person. And how else can I relate until I reach that step? And I reached that step with Yvonne last night. And hugging her was like my ninth step, making amends. And so I'm not sharing today the way I had planned to last week, to drop a little bricks on her, make her feel guilty for opposing her. I'd like you to know that there will be some conflicts in AA, and both people can be right, and both people can be human, or neither person can be fully right. And you got to walk through these, and you can still have a real fellowship as we do today. Anyway, it's a totally different spirit for me. And then I've got to keep daily aware of where my progress is. I've got to constantly inventory. See, a lot of people think as soon as they attack a problem, it's gone. I've been around to know that I don't know how to relate, and it's going to be a matter of degree. Growing a degree and losing a degree, and growing a few degrees and losing a few degrees. And unless I just keep a regular inventory of myself, I'm not going to see what's going to happen. And there's no way I can get to relate without the 11th step, meditation. Not prayer, meditation. Because I know what my problem is. I can't touch you unless I know I have something to give you. And the only way I will know that I'm lovable is through meditation, when I know that God loves me and I really am lovable. I take 5 to 15 minutes, and I take the same Bible text every single day, because my God is not truth in the mind, He's love in the heart. And only as I stay with a story day after day does it flow from the head into the heart, and I get new insights. And someone I sponsored a year ago plus told me that he writes out the results of his meditation. I filed it away. I started doing it about 6 months ago. And I don't know why this is working, and it just may be me, and it may never work for you. When I'm done meditating, I write a little bit of space on what I've experienced. And the writing, the meditation gets deeper and I get new insights. I don't know why it's working, but it is. I'm just sharing that because maybe 6 months from now you may pick a pen up and it may add something to yours. But I feel moments of love. And that enables me to come to the 12th step. And I'd like to start winding up with my last parable. A guy came to the Lord and he says, what do I need to have lasting life? And the Lord says, love God, love your neighbor as yourself. And the guy says, who's my neighbor? And the Lord told him a story about a man who was going down from Jericho, and he got beat up, and he was left on the side of the road, half dead. And some priests and some other people came by, and they passed him by. And a pagan, the Samaritans are non-believers, a pagan came by, and he saw him hurting. And he nursed him, and he poured oil on him, and he put him on his own donkey so that the man rode. And the pagan walked, and he took him to an inn, and he told the innkeeper, take care of him, and when I come back, if there's any bill, I'm going to pay it. And then the Lord asked the question. Now, the original question is, who is my neighbor? And the answer is very different. The Lord said, now, who is neighbor here? And they had to say, the one who helped him. And the question that we ask is, who is my neighbor? How do I relate? And the answer is, to whom will I be a neighbor? And I'm a neighbor to anyone I serve, to anyone to whom I carry the message. Because isn't this the answer of our whole program? You know, I was beaten up by life, and I was half dead. I was paralyzed laying along the side of a road. And good people will pass us by. I don't know a church that will welcome the people that we allow into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, practicing prostitutes and drug addicts and people out of prison and junkies. And we don't ask them to change anything. We just throw our arms open, and we give of ourselves, and we put them in our own homes. Like Yvonne was telling the story of her mother, we put ourselves out in so many ways. And we touch these people. Now, I don't know the answer. My sponsor told me to talk on this theme today because he said maybe if you do some talking, you'll follow it up with some action. You'll see where you're supposed to be going and you'll start heading there. I don't know how to relate. I hope you hear that. So I'm not giving you the answer to relationships. I'm giving you my understanding. And my understanding is if I'm wondering what you can give me or if I'm good enough for you, it's never going to happen. But when I know that God loves me and I see you hurting and I really believe that there's one person here that I can touch because there is love and there's an answer inside me, then that person is someone to whom I can be a neighbor. And if I go out and touch that person, this whole program starts working and the fellowship is real. Thank you very, very much.
Fast forward machine at this point to run off any remaining tape. Thank you.